The gross mischaracterization of American higher education.
Thanks, Tim. How are you?
Good, and thanks for being here. Thanks for letting us know about white gold. This was a big industry up until, what, the 50s?
Yeah, the heyday from 1920 to 1950, when it gave way to flooding in the Margaretville area, which took out some of the infrastructure around the selling of cauliflower, and also took out a bunch of farms in the way of the Papacton Reservoir, which was flooded intentionally. And some of those low-lying farms were taken out as a result, so it kind of went by the wayside. There was one company who, one farm that continued into the 90s called Rough Farms.
And in this episode, and this is what we're going to hear from CatsCast, we're going to talk about the notable contributions of the Van Benschoten family. Did I say that right?
I think Benschoten. Benschoten family, yeah, who brought cauliflower up from Long Island, where it was already being grown in the early 1900s, or actually the late 1800s. And thankful Van Benschoten planted seeds or seedlings of those cauliflower plants from Long Island in her windowsill in the Margaretville area. And that was the genesis of the entire industry here in the Catskills, which took over thousands of acres of farmland and was a huge industry.
And they're still celebrating the cauliflower at the annual Cauliflower Festival. It's the 20th year of the festival. That's coming up, actually, in Margaretville on September 21st. So let's take a listen to your episode from CatsCast about white gold, the rise and fall of Catskills cauliflower. Thanks, Brett.
Thanks, Tim. Enjoy.
This September, the Margaretville Cauliflower Festival celebrates its 20th year. And if you're thinking, well, that's interesting, but why cauliflower? Well, Catskill farmers grew a lot of it in the early 20th century, and in a good year, referred to it as white gold. To shed some light on the history of Catskill cauliflower, we talked to historian Diane Galusha, who once wrote a book about it, When Cauliflower Was King.
I am Diane Galusha, president of the Historical Society of the Town of Middletown, and the author of a little booklet printed 20 years ago called When Cauliflower Was King.
And when you say Middletown, some people think about another town which is south of the Catskills, but the town of Middletown encompasses what?
The town of Middletown is in Delaware County, not that Orange County where the city of Middletown is. Middletown incorporates two villages, Fleischmann's and Margaretville, and several hamlets, Arkville, New Kingston, Halkettsville, Dunraven. What am I forgetting? Something. I know I'm going to pay for that. But.
Yeah. How did cauliflower come to the Catskills?
That is an interesting question. William Van Benschoten and his wife, Thankful Van Benschoten, lived up on Margaretville Mountain and had a farm up there. And they had family on Long Island where cauliflower had been commercially grown for 10 years or so. And I think they got some plants there and or seeds from folks on Long Island and decided to try it in the Catskills and see how it would do, because it seemed to be doing pretty well on Long Island. And I think the Van Benschotens were looking for some way to supplement their income from the dairy. So the legend is that Thankful planted some of these cauliflower seedlings in her window boxes in her kitchen. Lo and behold, they grew. And it offered some promise of an interesting cash crop. So the next year they planted 200, and the following year they planted 2,000, and they were selling their cauliflower to boarding houses and hotels. The Van Benschotens got started in the 1890s, and their neighbors began to take note and began to do the same.
By 1910, you write that there were 18 acres planted in Delaware County compared to almost 1,500 acres in Suffolk County, where it was coming from or had kind of originated in the Long Island area. But that increased exponentially. By 1918, there were 230 acres in the Catskills devoted to cauliflower. 1924, 700. 1931, 3,000. So it grew and grew, and people were catching on that this was, I guess, a good hedge against the dairy farming business.
Yeah, and as soon as people showed that they were making a little money off of it, it seemed as though this is a crop that would thrive in the Catskills, you know, having cold nights and or cool nights anyway in the summer, and excellent soils for this particular crop. Lots of minerals that cauliflower seemed to need and want and did really well in. Farm families at the time had, you know, were generally big, generally had a number of young ones, and there was a lot of work to growing cauliflower. So they put everybody to work in the family and, you know, did everything from putting the seeds in the dirt in cold frames, basically. They would cook the dirt first to get rid of any bugs or microbes that might attack the seeds. And then as they grew, the seedlings got transplanted, and then they got put out in the field. They had to be, you know, hoed and tended to. They had to be fertilized. And
when you say they cooked the soil, they were building fires on top of the ground eliminate.
Well, not on top of the ground. The soil would be put in a container and heated. They weren't heating the ground itself. They were either wood fires or gas to heat the dirt. And one woman, you know, told me that she just loved the smell because it meant spring was here or about to be here. Wilma Jones's father was Imer Conroe, and she said that he used to say you could make so much money in cauliflower. One year you could buy a Cadillac, and then the next year you couldn't afford to put a license plate on it. It was that volatile sometimes. There were people who paid for new barns, who paid for new dining room sets. One woman said that her college education was partially paid for by cauliflower proceeds. There was also Brussels sprouts that people grew. One woman in Bovina said that their Brussels sprouts basically paid for their house. They bought a house for $8,000 or something like that, or a farm. They made it over time with the Brussels sprouts.
Which means that at this point in time, the heyday of cauliflower farming, 1920 to 1950, Americans must have been eating a lot of cauliflower and Brussels sprouts.
It would stand to reason. Yeah. Well, you know, it was interesting, too, because there were promotional efforts to explain to women in downstate homes and also restaurateurs, you know, what you can do with cauliflower, because a lot of people were unfamiliar with it. It started out being kind of a high-class vegetable that, because it was so labor-intensive and the seed was kind of expensive and you needed to pay somebody 25 cents an hour to go out there and work in the field, and so it cost a lot of money. So it was expensive on the other end as well to buy it in the market, and so it was considered a little bit high-class, but it became more accepted and acceptable as more and more cauliflower came on the market from different areas, too. I mean, Long Island was still producing a lot of cauliflower. Western New York, Erie County also produced a lot of cauliflower. So with additional supply, the prices came down, and they began to show people how to fix it, how to eat it, you know, what to serve with it. And later in the 30s, cauliflower growing cooperatives were established. There were three in this area, one in the Bovina area, one in Walton, and one here in Margaretville. They produced a cookbook.
You wrote about one of these booklets in your booklet, kind of billboarding the qualities of Catskills cauliflower. And here's what that says. The ideal mountain soil supplies Catskill Mountain cauliflower with the minerals which are assimilated by the human system and are so necessary to good health. Food that accelerates the gland action must be rich in vitamins, minerals, and supply roughage to promote peristalsis of the intestines. Sun-bathed Catskill Mountain cauliflower meets the requirements.
Yum! I'm going home and have some for dinner tonight.
but you can't because it won't be Catskill cauliflower.
Yeah.
It all folded up. So you'd need to be buying cauliflower from probably California or something. What happened to the industry here?
Well, let's see. Cauliflower is susceptible to something called brown rot, which began to infect fields. The other thing was competition. I mean, those Long Island growers, you know, they had proximity to the market. They didn't have, you know, two stones for every dirt to worry about like the folks here in the Catskills. It was a little easier to grow things down there, even though the Catskill farmers would tell you that Long Island cauliflower didn't hold a candle to Catskill Mountain cauliflower because of the richness of the soil here. But be that as it may, there was a lot of competition. That was kind of a double-edged sword. When everything worked, the crops were beautiful and abundant. And that, of course, lowered the prices because everybody had cauliflower to sell. On the other hand, if you had, you know, a rotten season and you didn't get any cauliflower, there was that too. So there had to be this weird balance that worked some years and didn't work other years. You know, it really cost quite a lot to grow a crate of cauliflower. Crates, you know, usually held about 12 big heads of cauliflower.
And crates were another business that was created here in the Catskills. People who weren't directly involved with growing the vegetable would build the crates, truck the product, lots of other things that were necessary to sell it.
Right.
Can you tell me a little bit about the auction process? I understand that there was an auction platform right in Margaretville where buyers, maybe from the city, would name their price for different grades of cauliflower.
Right. A couple of days a week in the high season, in the harvest season, August, September, the commission merchants from New York City markets would arrive and would look over the trucks full of cauliflower that farmers would drive down. This was in the 30s, late 30s and into the 40s, up to about 1950. Farmers would bring entire loads down, commission merchants would look at them, and there would be a bidding process depending on the quality and the amount maybe and the need on the part of the markets. This was an auction that was mutually run by the three cauliflower cooperatives. So then there would be trucks, additional trucks waiting to truck those loads down to whichever commission merchants bought them. The truckers would then leave immediately and drive all the way to the city and arrive there at night and, you know, wait their turn to offload and drive all the way back in the years before the throughway, and certainly in the years before Route 28 was improved to the point that it is. So it was an arduous trip, you know, it was just part of this long process that began very early in the spring with cooking that dirt.
It's funny you mention that, because with my modern mind, I'm thinking about old clunky trucks on the thruway. But no, it was old clunky trucks on
old clunky roads.
Old clunky roads. So it was always a fussy crop. It was a fussy crop in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s. Was there something other reason that by about 1950, it all kind of dissipated?
Well, there was a big flood in 1950 that took out the auction block and did considerable damage to a lot of farm fields. And prior to that, there was the Pepacan Reservoir, which was constructed in the 1940s through 1954 and took out many, many farms, river bottom farms that grew some wonderful cauliflower. So it was kind of a 1-2 punch, that and the competition and the brown rot, and people just basically gave up the growing of cauliflower on a commercial scale.
But one family didn't give it up. Ruff. Tell me about Ruff Farms and how they continued all the way up until 1995.
Yeah, Ruff Farms was a big truck farm in the New Kingston Valley, and they also had a dairy farm, but they utilized the flats there along the Plattekill Stream to grow cauliflower and zucchini and kale, I think, to some extent, and other produce. And they had a big packing house there. They employed a lot of people, seasonal workers, and they had used these big tractor trailers to truck their produce to markets in Baltimore and in Washington and in New York City and in Boston. They found a way to keep going into the 1990s. You know, people used to go to the farm, to the packing house there, and they would have paper grocery sacks, and you could fill up a grocery sack for a buck of cauliflower. It was pretty astounding.
You remember that?
Yeah.
What led you to write this book 20 years ago? I mean, you're a historian, you write books about the Catskills. Was there something about cauliflower that initially caught your eye or attracted you to that history?
Well, I'll be honest, I didn't know anything about the cauliflower industry until Carol Molnar came up with the idea of having a cauliflower festival. And I said, a cauliflower festival? What are you talking about? And she said, she reminded me that she lived on the farm that William Van Benskoten and Thankful started this industry at. You know, she thought she was interested in the history just because she was living it, essentially, or living in the midst of it. So, you know, it gradually grew on folks, and the Chamber of Commerce was among them, and the Historical Society was beginning to be formed. And so we thought, well, let's give it a shot and see if we can find a niche here, find some interest in bringing people to the area to learn about and celebrating Catskill agriculture. Then the festival is still going on. The 20th will be held on September 21st this year.
CatsCast, the Catskills podcast, is a biweekly production of Silver Hollow Audio. I'm Brett Berry. Thanks for listening, and eat your cauliflower.
Thanks, Brett Berry, for that. We always learn something new, as our next guest just said when she walked into the studio. It's Maggie Fitzpatrick. She is the health and wellness columnist for the Sullivan County Democrat, and her column is Moving Toward Health. It comes out every Tuesday on the stands and online at scdemocratonline.com. Are you a cauliflower eater?
I do eat some cauliflower, but maybe I'll have to eat some more now.
I'm inspired.
Yeah.
Your column, though, is not about cauliflower or cauliflower. I was not sure which is the correct pronunciation, but I think both will do. Your column is about setting more intentional goals, which could be to eat more cauliflower. But this comes from a saying that you say your dad repeated to you often, that callows can do anything. Who are the Callows?
That's my maiden name, so okay. That's my family. He was a Callow, and yeah, he always just said to us, Callows can do anything, Callows can do anything. And that really stuck with me my whole life. And what it turned into was one really great thing and one not so great thing. The really great thing was that I always believed I could do anything that I want. And the other side of that was that I kind of felt like I had to do everything. And there's a difference between pursuing what it is that you truly want to do and pursuing it well and stretching yourself so thin because you're trying to do everything and anything that presents itself to you.
And there's a little bit of pressure when it comes around setting goals. And, you know, I think I do this too. You write about the tendency to wait until a day that feels special or a month or a time of year. You don't think that's necessary?
I think that it can be helpful. Like if that you want to use that tool as a source of like inspiration or motivation, then do it. But if we use it as like, I'm going to wait until that day, as in I'm going to use that to put it off, then maybe that's where we need to check ourselves.
Yeah, whether that motivation is coming from inspiration or obligation. So a goal based around obligation feels different, you write. How so?
Yeah. So I'm a feeler. Like I feel things. I don't know if everyone relates to that, but when a goal feels exciting and light to me, we were just talking about sleep this morning, sometimes like you wake up from a good sleep, but you feel heavy, right? Well, when a goal feels light, then that's something that I want to pursue. When a goal feels heavy, then that's telling me that maybe there's pressure being put on me from somewhere, someone else, right? Maybe this is a societal obligation that I feel like I need to fulfill. Maybe this is a family obligation that I feel like I need to fulfill, a partner, a job or something, right? Where pressure is coming from someone else and I feel like I need to do this thing, but it's actually not what's best for me in this time. So I kind of use how I feel about it, like how I react, how my energy feels, how like light I feel about it as a way for me to gauge if a goal that I'm setting is one that is truly good for me or it's one where I feel like I'm doing it to please someone else.
You're asking why you're doing it, where it's coming from.
Yes.
And then you're giving yourself permission to be excited about it. Or let it go or change it, right?
Yeah, exactly. I feel like a lot of times with our health goals, we're like, oh, I should lose weight. Well, who said you should lose weight? Do you feel like you want to lose weight and that would be really good for your health? Or do you just feel like you should lose weight because everyone always says that they should lose weight, right?
Yeah.
So what kind of goal are we setting and why?
Well, I mean, you know, I hear from a doctor who says you could stand to lose a couple of pounds. So that's in the back of my mind. But then I'm kind of swirling around with the why, and I know the why, right? There's a health thing. But then it's the motivation. Like, I know I need to do something, but what is that? Like, and I'm still like circling around it, trying to figure it out versus this, I don't know, there's a little bit of a malaise about it.
Yeah, it's very complicated for sure. Like there's a lot of different factors that fall into it. And sometimes there's external pressure, like from a doctor that we do need to lean into, mm-hmm. right? But even with that, we can then still play around with the why. We can still play around with the how, right? Maybe mm-hmm. it's the how
the process.
Is we're more intentional about how and we do it in a way that feels more exciting to us than in a way that just feels very obligatory, right? Or
yeah.
just like, oh, everyone does this, so I guess I have to do it this
or
way.
Or I have to do it this way. I have to go to a gym, or I have to, like, you know, I don't know, cycle up a mountain, or, you know,
right.
all
yes.
these things.
Yeah.
Because you do go back to what you kind of started with here. And, you know, even though my family may not have been repeating this, but there is this idea of like, well, you can do anything. You can do anything. And then it creates this other pressure in some ways.
Yeah. I feel like it applies to any part of life, but health especially. I mean, I even run into it too, where I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to make a new program for myself, a workout program, right? And I want to do this goal, this goal, this goal, this goal. And I'm like, wait, Maggie, we can't focus on 8 things at once. Like, we don't even need to do that, right? Like, you're hearing all of this pressure about, oh, well, you should be stronger and you should also be leaner and you should be more toned and you blah, blah, blah. And it's like, okay, well, which one is most important and exciting to me right now? Maybe the one that's most exciting and important to me right now is being prepared for softball season or something, right? And I'm like, okay, well, that's what I want to focus on. And I don't need to focus on anything else. So I think it's important that we just take some time to maybe find a little bit of quiet, right? And I like to do this through writing or journaling, but everyone has their own different way. And finding a little bit of quiet and stillness and digging past those initial thoughts that are really loud to figure out what is really true and important to us, and then trying as best as possible to put some sort of blinders on and really focus on that, because it's easy to get distracted.
And I think you always sum these things up very well. And then this intentional goal setting, you say choose a goal that feels exciting, break down what you want to do each day to get there, and commit to showing up every single day. Consistent imperfection will always get us farther than inconsistent perfection. So that's a great way of summarizing what we've been talking about.
Yeah. It's okay to not be perfect. We just have to keep showing up, yeah. right? That's really all it comes down to.
Maggie Fitzpatrick, Moving Toward Health, is the column in the Sullivan County Democrat. She joins us every Tuesday to tell us about it and get us motivated. You can read it on newsstands or online, scdemocratonline.com. Thanks, Maggie.
Thank you.
We'll take a break. Oh, well, we're done. Actually, it's the end of the show. So we're going to take a break and go to another show. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder, we'll bring you NPR news coverage of the presidential debate between former President Donald Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris from Philadelphia tonight, starting at 9 here on Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Jeff Bank, Sullivan County's community bank, celebrating 110 years of service this year. Offering deposit and loan products for all your banking needs. Member FDIC and an equal housing lender. National Mortgage Licensing System and Registry Identification Number 405318. Jeff Bank. Still banking strong. And support comes from listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, and this week on Latino USA, part two of our award-winning series, The Moving Border. We travel next to Tapachula, the new frontier for asylum seekers at the border between Mexico and Guatemala.
¿Tú has visto esta persona?
No, yo no conozco porque hay mucho que diferente aquí en la plaza.
That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at wjffradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, sunny, a high 72. Tonight, clear, a low 45. And the warm-up this week continues tomorrow, sunny and pleasant. Wednesday, 75, 78 Thursday, 79 Friday, and up to 80 by Saturday. On Point is next. You're listening to Radio Catskill. It's 11 o'clock.